Welcome to Your Health, the best of this week's stories from the health desk here at NPR. I'm Rebecca Davis. This week, breast cancer screening in African-American women. Writer and surgeon Atul Gawande discusses how to foot the bill for health care. And is chocolate milk or a candy bar in drag? But first, confusion and anger. That's been the reaction from many camps since new recommendations on breast cancer screening came out weeks ago. But perhaps the concern is greatest among African-American women who die of the disease at an earlier age and more often. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
When you look at the death statistics for breast cancer in African-American women and compare them to white women, it's stunning. Beginning in their 20s, black women are twice as likely to die of breast cancer as white women who have breast cancer. In older black women, there are fewer cases of breast cancer, but the high death rates persist. Vanessa Shepherd is a behavioral scientist at Georgetown University. She's conducting a study to understand the response of African-American women to treatment for breast cancer. So she's seen this up close.
In my study, we've lost, and this has been a relatively small study, but we've lost about 8 African-American women, and that's a pretty high mortality rate. And about 200 women, so that's pretty high so far. And personally, I've lost friends that were 32, 36, and 40 from breast cancer.
Studies estimate that 20 to 30% of breast cancers in African-American women are triple-negative breast cancers. They don't respond to any of the treatments known to block the cancer's growth.
The breast cancer is more aggressive, meaning that the tumors are harder to treat. They're larger.
Similar types of aggressive breast cancers have been found in other ethnic groups, including Africans, suggesting perhaps a genetic link. But no one knows exactly why. There are known risk factors for breast cancer and combinations of risk factors. A family history of the disease, age at which menstruation and menopause start, but no one has come up with a satisfactory model to predict breast cancer in black women. Lovell Jones is the head of the Minority Research Center at the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. He says what's happening with breast cancer death rates is similar to what's happening with the higher infant mortality rate in the African American community.
What it gives an indication of is maybe the age of the body with regards to environmental stressors.
In other words, stress may be causing premature aging. It's not a popular theory, but he says in part it may come down to simply being black in America.
It could be induced in terms of discrimination and perceived discrimination. It could be due to living in an environment that produces stress. You know, all the things that are going on in Chicago with, you know, kids being killed, well, that adds stress, community stress.
Even after adjustments are made for education, poverty, and other factors, the mortality rate remains high. Studies suggest that African-American women don't get screened for breast cancer as often as white women, and when they do, it is later in life. Often the mammograms are not routine screening mammograms, but rather they're done because the woman or her doctor felt a mass in her breast. They usually show up at Surgeon Regina Hampton's office with the mammogram in hand.
I certainly have women that come into my office that had a mass, and because of their young age, many health practitioners still don't believe that a young woman can get breast cancer. These cancers are then, once they come to me, are found at a later stage. So then we're kind of running behind the eight ball trying to get the patient treated.
There are also questions about the care that African-American women receive, whether they are referred to cancer specialists in a timely way, and understand that they will need therapy after surgery. With all the issues surrounding black women and breast cancer, some health professionals say they should get mammograms earlier and more frequently. The question for Georgetown's Vanessa Shepherd is whether starting at 40 is good enough.
The tumors are growing fast, and the intervals that we prescribe may not work. And so how can we have better diagnostic tools, how can we have better screening tools that can capture the women that aren't the average women?
It's a challenge many African-American women will have to come to grips with. About a third of them are younger than 50 years of age when they get breast cancer. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
Some critics of the new recommendation for mammograms think they know why experts suggested women wait until they're 50. Just one of the accusations came from the American College of Radiology. They said the government advisory panel suggested women get fewer mammograms as a way to cut costs. Republicans in Congress claim the same thing. The scientists who made the recommendations insist money had nothing to do with their calculations. Although the question still remains, would performing fewer mammograms save money? We're going to try to set aside the politics and just look at the facts here. NPR's Tamara Keith joined Steve Inskeep in the studio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Remind us what the panel is calling for here exactly.
The panel is this U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, and they're saying that women 50 and older should get mammograms to screen for breast cancer every 2 years instead of every 1 year, which has been the standard. And for women age 40 to 49, what they're saying is that they should talk to their doctors, that mammograms should no longer be routine in their 40s, but that they should carefully consider it. And many will probably decide to keep getting mammograms.
But let's say that millions of women did actually follow this recommendation and get mammograms later and less often. Would that save money?
Yes. But the panel did not look at that. They insist they didn't. And I had a hard time getting people to talk to me about this on tape simply because of all the fallout from this for the last several weeks. So I was able to get a researcher to help me do the math. And what he said was that you do some rough calculations, and you suppose all women in their 40s stopped getting mammograms. Everyone else got fewer. Say a mammogram costs $100. That would save around $2 billion on mammograms.
If women actually all followed these recommendations, which they might not, what other costs would be affected?
Well, there are biopsies. Over a decade, a woman has a 1 in 3 chance of having a false positive, which means a further workup, likely a biopsy. One researcher calculated in a paper a few years ago that we spend $1 billion a year on potentially unnecessary biopsies. And then the researchers I spoke to also said that there are real issues with overdiagnosis and overtreatment. Because we do a lot of mammograms, we catch a lot of slow-growing cancers that may never have made people sick. And so thousands of women may be getting mastectomies and chemo and radiation that didn't need it, who never would have gotten sick. If you add all those things up, it comes to about $4 to $5 billion in possible unnecessary spending. Though compared to our nation's health care bill, it isn't a lot of money.
So there are some possible savings on the table here, but aren't there also some possible costs if women get mammograms later and less often? Because there are some cancers that would be caught later and perhaps treatments that would have to be more extensive and women that would die.
Yes, but this is also where the math gets very fuzzy, because even annual mammograms often don't catch the most aggressive cancers at an early stage, and delaying treatment of the slow-growing cancers may not do any harm at all. So it's just incredibly hard to do the math on this, and the reality is that women aren't doing that kind of math. For them, it's not about averages. This is our health we're talking about here. People don't make decisions based on probabilities. It's one person weighing out risks and benefits. And at least for people with insurance, they aren't even thinking about cost at all.
NPR's Tamara Keith, thanks very much.
Thank you.
To help make sense of the debate on mammograms and other health care issues, go to Shots, which is NPR's health blog. There, NPR's Julie Robner decodes the Senate health care debate, and our science team outlines a famous brain autopsy that could help scientists better understand memory.
Now let's talk about the problem of paying for health care. While the gigantic health care bill does a lot, critics say it fails to do much to cut our soaring health insurance costs. Surgeon and writer Atul Gawande thinks it may be fine to fudge that goal for now. He spoke with NPR's Steve Inskeep.
Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You point out that all the health care bills have are various pilot programs to explore ways to cut costs rather than mandates to cut costs for the most part. What example in history makes you think this could actually work?
Well, the interesting part about it is that we've been through this before. A century ago, we were in a situation where 40% of our spending was on another human need, and that was food. 40% of family incomes went to just paying for food, and half the American workforce was tied up in farming. We were still a poor nation as a result, and we were as desperate about food costs then as we are about healthcare costs now. And if you were standing at the start of that last century, just as we are now, saying, what are we going to do about this? At the time, what we came up with was just a bunch of pilot programs.
What do you mean?
Well, at the time, we had some vague ideas that farmers weren't as productive as they could be. We knew that they weren't plowing deep enough. We knew that they weren't rotating their crops, doing things that science had said, look, this would give you higher production, which would mean lower costs and better quality for farms and so on. And we were very frustrated. We said we needed a fix for all this. And so what they began trying at the first half of the century in communist countries was, well, let's take over the farms. Let's do scientific farming. And we know what that led to was widespread famine, tens of millions of deaths. The U.S. tried, instead of a grand, let's fix it all now solution, we kept the private farms. We had individual initiative, but we brought government to try to help the millions of farmers to change the way they work.
You actually trace it down to a single farmer who agreed to use a single piece of his land in Texas in 1903 to try some new techniques.
Yeah, it was very interesting. It was a single pilot project. This government bureaucrat named Seaman Knapp persuaded farmers in Terrell, Texas, to pick just one of their farms where they would try to produce food, or in this case, cotton, at higher yield and lower cost. And the way that he went about it is they found Roger Porter, who agreed to do it on a corner of his farm, and gave him a few things to just try. By the end of the year, he made much more profit than all of his neighbors. The neighbors started saying, hey, we can do this too. And the process then moved across Texas and Louisiana, where you had the Extension Service, extension agents coming in, helping farmers not just with cotton, but corn and wheat and livestock, saying, what are the best practices that your fellow farmers are doing? And let's get you to just give it a try. And supplying that kind of middleman role, the government ended up driving a process that within a decade and a half had cut the prices by half.
You raised this very hopeful analogy to the way that farming was improved over the course of the 20th century. And yet I wonder if it would actually be easier to change farming than it would be healthcare, because you could go, a guy could go to one farmer and persuade him to try one thing and have a demonstrable result within a few months that other farmers could copy, whereas the healthcare system is this huge and interrelated industry with trillions of dollars at stake and a lot of people that would have to be persuaded to try even a small experiment.
You're right. I talked to the extension agent from my home county in Athens, Ohio.
Farm extension agent.
The farm extension agent. And he described to me that there are about 100 crops and livestock that he tries to make sure are being produced in ways that are becoming less environmentally harmful and are of high quality and good yield. You look in my county and ask, how many diagnoses do the doctors and hospitals take care of? It's more than 13,000. Organizing the care so we can make sure that everything from a breast cancer to a traumatic road traffic accident to a headache is cared for as well as possible, following the evidence and organizing things so you don't waste any moves, do totally unnecessary things. There is no question in my home county or where I practice in Boston that we can do phenomenally better than we're currently doing. Imposing the solution on us is not going to succeed, but we don't have the pressure now to be able to solve it. The idea of pilot programs and incentives and experiments like these really is putting that pressure on us to begin reorganizing, really reforming healthcare.
Atul Gawande is a surgeon in Boston and a writer for The New Yorker. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The battle for healthier school lunches has featured fights over soda and claims that ketchup is a vegetable. And now the lines are being drawn over chocolate milk. Some schools have banned it altogether. And as NPR's Jeff Brady reports, the dairy industry is fighting back.
Lunchtime at Flatirons Elementary in Boulder, Colorado. But there's no chocolate milk on the menu. It's a topic of discussion among second graders like Ella Lyons.
No one's going to get regular milk if we have chocolate milk, because I think they're going to like it better because it tastes better. But it's not good for you, so I think we shouldn't have chocolate milk.
Standing nearby is Ann Cooper. She's responsible for expelling chocolate milk from the entire school district. That sort of behavior has earned her a nickname, the Renegade Lunch Lady.
Believe it or not, serving kids salad bar and organic milk is seen as renegade.
So what's your beef with chocolate milk?
Chocolate milk is soda and drag, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that's kind of funny, but, I mean, is that really true? Because, I mean, there are nutrients in chocolate milk that aren't in soda, right?
That is true, but from a sugar standpoint, in many chocolate milks, there's 3.1 grams of sugar per ounce. Soda is 3.3. It's so close.
There are no hard statistics showing how many schools have gotten rid of chocolate milk so far, but it's clearly enough to worry the dairy industry.
I'm raising my hand for chocolate milk. How about you?
The industry launched this campaign recently with a video on Facebook and an online petition to keep chocolate milk in schools.
Your bodies need to grow healthy and strong.
Chocolate milk in lunchrooms is big business. More than half of all flavored milk is sold in schools. That's about 4% of all milk sales in the U.S. And the lunchroom is a good place for the dairy industry to pick up new customers. Kids will take eating habits they learn here into their adult lives. And that's important because of one significant statistic that's been bugging the dairy industry for decades. Here's Ohio State University dairy economist Cameron Thrain.
The per capita consumption of fluid milk in all of its formulations has been declining in the U.S. Since the 1960s.
The Raise Your Hand for Chocolate Milk campaign is part of the industry's effort to stop that slide. Anne Marie Krautheim is a dietitian with the National Dairy Council.
We know that when flavored milk is taken out of the school, kids' milk consumption goes down.
And she says children already don't drink enough milk. Krautheim says when other choices include sugary juices and soda, milk needs a sweet flavor to compete.
A small amount of added sugar is an acceptable trade-off for the nutrients provided in milk.
Back at Flatirons Elementary, though, most of the students appear to be signing up with the Renegade Lunch Lady. Jacob Boston is a fifth grader.
Well, I'm pretty sure chocolate milk has maybe some unhealthy ingredients in it, and the little ones might get, like, addicted to it, so...
There is one contingent seated at a nearby table crying out for choice. Here's Lindsay Lavington and Juliana Yeager.
Some people won't drink any milk if it's not chocolate milk.
But you're drinking regular milk.
I know, but other people
don't. Because we don't have the choice right now.
Renegade Lunch Lady Ann Cooper says there are healthy ways to make milk more palatable to kids. For starters, make sure it's kept really cold. And those little paper cartons that sometimes smell funny... She says, get rid of them. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
And that's all for Your Health. Please join us again next week for more of the best from the Health Desk here at NPR. If you'd like to write us, you can do so at nprhealth@npr.org. That's nprhealth@npr.org. I'm Rebecca Davis. Thanks for listening.